This podcast is brought to you by Zeno Mueller, three-time Olympian and gold medalist. Imagine a 20-second 2K PR by the end of this season, or even sooner. Elite rowing coach by Zeno Mueller is a competitive advantage. The ERG score is the SAT of rowing, so find out what Zeno Mueller can do for you. Make sure to use coupon 4STARS, F-O-R-S-T-A-R-S, for $200 off on any program he has on his website. Zeno is an Olympian and graduate from Brown University, coached by the legendary Steve Gladstone. He'll get you right, he'll get your 2K down, and you'll be a better athlete after his training. So make sure you tune in with Zeno and get some coaching at EliteRowingCoach.com.
On tonight's program, ladies and gentlemen, we have something that's going to make you sick.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the 4STARS podcast. Today, we are featuring our first Australian national teamer, Michael Toon. People call him Toonie, former coxswain for the Australian national team. Cox of the 2004 Summer Olympic Games when the United States crushed you guys, but it's okay because, anyways, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. You know, we had Mary Whipple on. You're friends with Mary. And so I was like, oh, I'll get Mike on. We'll get him on here. But I wanted to touch on how the Australian national team actually works, because in America, we're going through it right now. The Olympics are happening in Paris this summer. We just had our first winter speed order to kind of test our speed. But how does the national team in Australia work? Because it's a continent, right? But it's also, you know, just one big team. So can you dive into that?
Yeah, sure. So it's a bit different now than when I was on the team. It started off pretty similar to how the US did, where the winning, you know, InterVarsity crew would represent the United States. So back historically, we had this big race between the seven states of Australia called the King's Cup. And the winner of the King's Cup would then go on to represent Australia. So they'd all be from one state and often from one boat club. But then we realized after not doing so well that combining everyone's talents into the 1-8 and was a better approach. And that started around sort of the mid last century. It evolved to, yeah, just finding out who the best athletes were, putting them in an eight for a couple of months before the World Championships or Olympic Games. And that was kind of the setup, which was around when I was on the team. So my Olympic crew came from two guys from Western Australia, one guy from Victoria, two of us were from Queensland, and the rest were from New South Wales. And we got together and trained just for the Olympics, having been selected around March or April from memory. These days, though, they decided to like centralize the whole program shortly after I left the national team. So from about 2016, 2012 onwards, that Olympic cycle, they brought everyone to what's called the National Training Center in Canberra for the men and in Penrith, where the Olympic course is for women. So they sort of train year round now together as one big national squad. And that's where they'll pull the various team boats. Not to say you have to be at the NTC to make the team, but it's all centralized now. And you will basically apply and compete for positions at the NTC. And then that's your footstep into the national team from there.
While you were there, how many other coxswains were you competing against to get into the eight? Or was it just you?
No. So in my year was a bit unusual. There used to be a thing also called the AIS, which was the Australian Institute of Sport. And so you could once again apply to train there. And that was, you'd get access to elite coaching, sports science, and that was all training in Canberra. But that wasn't like a ticket onto the national team the way the NTC works these days. You would be at the AIS, but you'd be in amongst a pool of athletes with every other person from clubs and states around the country. They would always have a cox for the Atlanta and Sydney Olympic cycle, and so they were usually always the front runner. And back when I was competing, there was a very successful cox called Brett Heyman, who coxed the Sydney Olympic 8 to a silver medal. They lost that race by only about a canvas, but had they won the gold, he would have been the only cox I know of to have won gold in the lightweight eight, the cox pair, the cox four, and the eight at the Olympics or the World Championships, which would have been an incredible achievement. But he's still one of the most decorated coxswains in Australian history. And he was the guy, you know, at the time. But fortunately, he retired after Sydney. And then I stepped into the eight in 2001 because I'd had the under 23 eight up until that point, off and on for the last 4 years. And then my eight got a seventh place at the Lucerne World Championships in 2001. That's where I first met Mary, actually, because that was her first World Championships as well. She was fourth in the women's eight. Yeah, I got booted out of the eight in 2002. And I got the Cox pair that year. And there was another Cox who had been my rival for the under 23 eight who got the Aussie eight. They came seventh again. And then I went to a third coxswain in 2003, another guy from Victoria who'd had the under 23 eight in 2002. And that kind of the selectors were, there wasn't much between us. We didn't get many racing opportunities. I hadn't done so well on the eight. And then the guy who replaced me hadn't done so well on the eight. So they gave this third guy. And then they came fifth, qualified the boat for the Olympics. And so there was three guys who'd all had the Australian eight in that Olympic cycle who were vying for the position in 2004. So it was pretty hot. And what they basically did was they brought us to a camp in Canberra around December, I think. So around in our summer. From there, they cut it down to two of us. And that was me and the guy who had the eight in 2003. And then we all came along to the final selection regatta. We each got a turn in the boat. And they had a big crew meeting and cut it down to just me, thankfully.
Oh, wow. You can make a book out of that, to be honest. Today's podcast is brought to you by Pocock Racing Shells, a name synonymous with championship-winning boats and groundbreaking innovation for over a century. For 113 years, Pocock has been the heartbeat of rowing, crafting boats that have conquered waters, broken records, and earned medals like no other. Our legacy is your assurance of quality and performance. Our dedicated customer base includes prestigious Division I colleges and universities, as well as countless smaller schools and clubs across the USA. We're honored to be your trusted partner in the world of rowing. But what sets Pocock apart? We remain family-owned, committed to preserving our rich tradition of handcrafting every boat right here in Everett, Washington. With unparalleled service, staff, and decades of knowledge, we are well prepared to help keep you on the water and ready for race day. Be sure to catch us at this year's upcoming regattas, where we'll be unveiling the future of rowing, the X1X and the X4, the next evolution in our X Series boats coming in 2024.
But in that environment, it's ruthless, it's cutthroat, because as you know, there's only one coxswain seat at the Olympics. It gets pretty tight fit for three people into one seat, obviously, and it was a hectic time, yeah.
Yeah, the Olympic committee are figuring out to see if the Cox 4 is going to be around for the next Olympics, you know, not this one, but yeah. Starting in 2025, there's talk that it will be brushed off no more. So it will still be like a national race. Like people can, you know, race the Cox 4 nationally, but not internationally, which would be, you know, only technically one spot for a coxswain. When you were in 04, what was the weather like out there?
Yeah. So that's a good question because we don't get together, my crew, very much, but whenever we do, we talk a lot about the weather because we had a massive tail breeze for the heat and then it flipped and was a massive tail breeze for the final. So we had to race the heat in the final very differently, which is a challenging thing to do, particularly when like the US 8 and us and the Dutch even, all the medalist boats hadn't actually raced much before. So all those three crews that made the podium kind of came out of nowhere. Yeah, so it was challenging because crews that had raced a lot, you know, would be able to adapt to the conditions and be able to know how to manage those things. But we expected it to be really rough. The World Junior Championships were on the same course the year before and they got blown. The regatta was basically blown off the course. They were both sinking. I think there was an eight that the Cox had to like swim the boat over the line in the heats to qualify because the eight just got submerged because the weather was so bad. So we went over there expecting the course to be potentially unrowable at times. It was mad. So people turned up with like pumps for their boats, massive splash guards to attach to the bow canvas to keep the waves out. And then when it happened, the race, the water wasn't unrowable, but it was like really rough. The heat, I'm not sure, it's not available to see online, but the heat was a roaring tail breeze. The US-Canada race in the heat was one for the ages. The US broke the world record. I mean, we came down in the first heat and we just killed it. We were like clear water in front at 1500 meters. We got to the 1500 meter mark in 4 minutes flat, which is like at the time that was blistering.
Yeah.
And then we just cruised over the line and rode a 4:23. So we were like we were about half a second off the world record at the time, just cruising over the last 500 meters. It was that quick. And then we got off the water thinking we'd done pretty well. And then we turned around and we saw this humdinger of a race between the US and Canada where the US broke the world record. And we were like, well, we thought we were doing well, but that's like the fastest an eight's ever gone. So, and then funnily enough, Canada were leading that heat to the 1500 in 4:01. So we were a second faster in our heat to the 1500. So we knew that the eights out there were like red hot, lightning fast. But then we rocked up to the final, of course, and all week it had been a tail breeze. We rode a 1,000 meter piece that week in 2:36. I mean, it's just incredibly fast. And then we turned up to the final, and of course the wind had swung around. I think the US won the final in like 5:42, which is you know, goes to show how big a stiffer head breeze it was. So yeah, it was a very different race. It was all totally rowable, but very, very different race, the final. And it very much favoured, I think, those US guys who were, they were so strong, those guys, really, really strong, big men, you know. It just goes to show how much the Olympics is very much a mind game.
Sure.
As well as a feat of strength and technical ability.
Did you ever watch the American documentary about the 2000 Olympics?
Yeah, I did see that. That was made by a friend of mine, Brad Lewis. So yeah, I've hung out with Brad a few times in California. And so I really like everything he makes, his writing and his filmmaking.
It was unreal. I probably watched the documentary about four or five times. And every time I'm just in awe at the end. It's just, and I talked to a couple of the athletes that were in that documentary, and Porter Collins, obviously Pete. It's unreal to see that event, you know, actually happen. Because you see movies, a lot of times they make up stuff, but that was real life. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, sport's the greatest drama. You can't reproduce that stuff as much as you might try.
With Mary, we talked about the top 10 things that Coxon needs to, you know, nail every time, or at least to work on every day of practice. If you had to explain the top 10 things that Coxon needs to make sure that they have down, what would you say?
Most people, when they're learning coxing, go straight to wanting to know how to motivate a crew, not realizing that comes like way down the list. You know, you've got to be a good, safe set of hands, a reliable set of hands. I always say that like a good cox is a guy who doesn't necessarily make the boat go faster every time, but definitely doesn't slow it down. So you can't slow the boat down as a cox. You've got to steer straight. You've got to steer good lines. Always have tools with you. So always make sure you look after what an old coach of mine used to call like the hygiene factors, which is just making sure that, you know, everyone's healthy and safe and the boat's healthy and safe, you know, to go fast. People, when they go out initially, you know, when they're learning how to cox, they'll get this, like, they'll be told, you know, you've got to steer the boat straight. You've got to call the race plan. You've got to tell the crew where they are on the course, tell where the other crews are, respond to moves from the other crew, correct any technical faults, motivate the crew, get these huge long lists, and it's impossible, like, to do all those things. So I say when you're learning, you know, first of all, when you go out there for a race, just steer the boat straight. That's all you got to do. And if you do that, then you get a 10 out of 10. The next time you go out to race, steer the boat straight and tell the crew like where the 250, where the 500 is, that sort of thing. And then, you know, do that a couple of times. And the next time you go out, you tell the crew, you steer the boat straight, you tell the crew where they are on the course, and you start telling them where the other crews are around. And then you layer it. And then by the end of the season, you're able to do all those things that you're expected of you, but you can't do it in the first go. That's crazy. So you don't always want the crew like revved up. If it's going well, sometimes you actually want them to calm down, stay inside themselves, save a bit of that for the end. So it's just controlling their mental and emotional state. Same with in training. You know, you can't go 10 out of 10 all the time in training, foot to the floor, redlining it. There's going to be times when you're wanting to be more chilled, those sorts of things, yeah.
How close were you with your coach on the team?
Very close to the coach, yeah. So we were very fortunate. We had Tim McLaren coached us. He's a bit of a legendary coach. He was recently inducted into the Australian Sports Hall of Fame, which is a pretty massive achievement in a sport like rowing, which is a fairly anonymous sport, even if you're a superstar.
Of course. We're talking about all these athletes, and I think I mentioned this to someone. I said, if you could make an eight, you know, who would you put in that eight? And someone said eight Hamish Bonds. I thought that was kind of fun. But I mean, it could be, that might be one heck of an eight. How did you prepare for the 04 games?
Yeah, I mean, you just have to go in there like it's any other day. Yeah, basically, it's just there happens to be a lot of television cameras on you and a lot of people turn up to watch the race and they give out some shiny medals at the end of the race. I mean, it's all pretty cool. But if you think about that stuff, then it's a distraction. You go in there like it's any other day. I mean, the things that I was doing for the Olympic final was the same things that I was doing, you know, when I was a schoolboy. I was making sure I knew what the race plan was. I was talking to the coach. I was checking the boat, made sure I knew what time the race was starting, you know, what lane we were in, that I'd got my weigh-in out of the way, you know, that I knew where the athletes were, that I knew that they knew what the plan was, that I knew what the warm-up was, that I knew what the conditions were doing. And you just go over that stuff in your mind. And then it's just about, you know, executing. You go in there with the confidence knowing that you've done it hundreds of times before. Yeah. I mean, if you hadn't done it hundreds of times before, there's no way you'd be in that position. So it was all just a matter of doing what you'd trained to do. You fall back onto your preparation, basically.
Totally. Where did you clock in at? What weight were you at when you got to the final? Do you remember?
55.00.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Wow. I weighed 55.00 for every one of my international weigh-ins.
Did you have to cut a lot, or was that just natural for you?
A bit of a mix, yeah. So I sat around 58 kilos. So what's that going to be, like 120 something pounds? Yeah. I would get about as heavy as I ever got was about 59, 60, maybe a little more. I'd just sort of slowly drift down. We had to weigh in for our national championship and for selection regattas, which were around March and April. So I kind of had a test run earlier in the year where I'd get myself down. And then when we were racing overseas, it was European summer, so it was easy to be active. So I'd walk a lot during the day when we were staying and training overseas. And I'd sit around sort of 56 coming into the regatta. And then I'd just dehydrate a little bit. But I'd pretty much wake up the day of the race about 54.7 or 8 sort of thing. And so then when I went away and I'd just take a water bottle with me, I'd drink a bit of water up on the test scales until I was 55.00. And then I'd go and clock that weight.
That is a skill in and of itself. I'm talking to my grandpa about rowing, and he's doesn't really know too much about it, but he obviously knows stuff through me. And I'm explaining to him, like, Grandpa, I have to cut weight or I have to do this. And he's like, well, son, you're already as tiny as can be. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry, I gotta cut weight. He goes, is this healthy? And I'm like, I'm doing what I gotta do. Before this podcast, we talked a little about me and how I got into it, but yeah. I want to know more about how you got into the sport too.
I wasn't like allowed to play a lot of like contact team sports. I was born with a serious heart condition, and I had heart surgery when I was 3. To fix that. And then when I grew up, I started having some arrhythmias. I got a pacemaker put in when I was like 7 to control those. And I was pretty active, like young kid at that stage, playing like team hockey and stuff like that. But I was small, so I was never like an outstanding athlete. But my brother played rugby. My father and uncle all played rugby. Yeah, I really liked team sports, but there was just nothing that I could really do to make it work with the limitations that were put on me. My brother started rowing at school, and my dad saw the coxes going around and thought that, you know, that might suit me. So he rang up like the coach and said, hey, my son, you know, would like to cox. And then he told me like later about that conversation, took me down and like threw me in a boat. I was like literally going down thinking I was just going to get in, go for like a quick circle around the river and come back in and make up my mind whether I liked it. But, the very first row I ever did was like about 30 miles, I think, like enormous, yeah, row in. And these were like under 15 kids, so like 14-year-old school kids in 4s. So like the slowest boat you could imagine. And it took us like 4 or 5 hours. And that was the first time I ever got in a boat. And I wouldn't necessarily say I was hooked, but I could see that there was something which I could do well. So, and it was a team sport. So I was kind of sold on it from there.
Hold on a second, because you're saying 4 to 5 hours, your first time ever in a boat before?
Yeah, that's right. In a really slow boat too. I forget the exact hours, but we would train 3 times a day, every day, except Thursday mornings off and Sunday afternoons off. We'd row for like 2 hours straight up, and then we'd come off, have breakfast, have a little meeting, and then we'd go out and have like a more technical session for about an hour. The first session in the morning was about maybe 20 Ks, and then the second session was more like 10 to 12 Ks. And then we'd rest in the middle of the day, and then the afternoon we'd either row again, or we'd go to the gym, or we'd do cross training on ergos. Thursday mornings was a sleep in after we had like a Wednesday crew dinner. And then Sunday mornings we would cycle. We'd cross train on mountain bikes, and the guys would go like on a 2-hour mountain bike ride, and I'd go for like a walk or a run for that time along the beach. We were lucky because we were in Sydney, so we had access to the Nepean River at Penrith, which was like a long, still course, and we'd go and do a long row there, or we'd go to the Sydney Olympic course and do timed stuff there on a Saturday morning.
What would you say were some of the things that you really liked about Tim McLaren and his coaching style?
Well, he's a real coxswain's coach in as much he's very technical and very analytical. He did stuff with me which I'd sort of never done before, which was good. And I like simple stuff too, which is kind of obvious in hindsight. But he'd like make me write down everything that I said and the phraseology of what I said and get me to explain to him what I meant by it. So I was really trying to work out like the stuff that I commonly said, whether it was useful and then whether it was a different way that I could say it. Because I would naturally, obviously, incorporate a lot of stuff that he said. And then we'd try and make sure, like, he'd say, what do you mean when you say that? And then this is what I mean when I say it. We'd make sure that we understood the same thing. He'd want to make sure I had a clear understanding of what was meant by it as well. Or we'd also realize that if I said the same stuff to the guys over 6 months, you know, it might work at the start, but by the time we got overseas, you know, it was just noise. So I'd sort of try and vary what I said, try and think of new ways of saying stuff. That was really useful. When the coach is there, you kind of know the coach is there. They bring with them some undefinable presence. If you were a regatta and Mike Teddy was there, you knew he was there, because all of a sudden people would be carrying themselves differently and behaving differently, you know, whether it was a combination of trying to impress Mike, doing stuff because you cared about the result for him, that sort of stuff. And Tim was the same.
Well, that's where they work together now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I think they saw a lot of each other.
They've joined forces.
They saw a lot of themselves in each other, I think.
Yeah, basketball players, football players, they look at film every day. You know, that's part of their job, is they have film study. And so I think with us, it's more about audio, obviously, and how the coxswains are controlling their boat. But I do feel like if more coxswains spent more time doing their research or even just watching film of other crews, it would really help. Anyways, that's...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I actually had a voice coach leading up into Athens. We went and got in touch with someone who worked with like actors in theater actors, and they gave me like a made me read some like famous, you know, speeches from plays to work on how I was communicating and how I would say certain words. And you know, you try and get that light and shade into what you're talking about, accentuate the important things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it necessarily made me a better cox, but couldn't have hurt.
Yeah. What would you say are some of the things that you've learned from being a coxswain that shape you into who you are today?
I'm an anaesthetist now. So in the US, that would be an anaesthesiologist. So I work in a lot of like team environments where you've got to have a plan. You've got to appreciate everyone on the team, use everyone's skills. Yeah, all that sort of stuff I learned through rowing. So, and you've got to be a really good communicator. Yeah, so I mean, there's not a day that goes by at work that I'm not appreciative of the skills that I learned, you know, from being around crews, definitely. It was also just like there's intangible sort of stuff. Like, you know, I would never have gotten where I got in rowing without just going down there and trying it, jumping in the boat, you know, seeing what happened. So I'm really keen on new experiences and trying things out, because, you know, you never know what's like, you know, what's out there for you.
I did want to say it was a pleasure talking to you. And I also hope that, you know, down the line, maybe we can get you back on if you have some more time away from, you know, your job in medical field.
It's been a pleasure. If anyone wants to hit me up, I'm on Instagram, and it's at Dr. Tooney, DrTooney on Instagram. That's about my only social media presence. Thanks for the chat.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate you.